Many of us have homes full of stuff. Mementos, expanding collections of books, shoes, old magazines, rarely used sports equipment. And for some of us, our attachments to what we can keep can spiral out of control. And not just the most extreme cases like the Collier brothers. On this week's Please Explain, we're going to find out about compulsive hoarding. And joining us now is Dr. Robin Zasio, a therapist who specializes in treating hoarding and other anxiety-related disorders. She's contributed to the A&E show Hoarders and is the author of The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. It's published by Rodale. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Is hoarding an anxiety-related disorder?
It is. Interestingly enough, it has not been formally diagnosed, but it is clearly, almost an epidemic where estimates right now are over 3 million people are suffering from compulsive hoarding. But because so many people live in silence, we really believe that that's a gross underestimate.
Is the condition related to depression or other anxiety disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder?
They absolutely can be. We see a fair amount of people that have both conditions in terms of OCD and compulsive hoarding. And certainly depression can be a contributor. When people are depressed, they can engage in behaviors that are not so healthy, and shopping is a way to distract and occupy yourself. But on the back end, some people will develop compulsive hoarding as a result of loss and trauma. And then as their houses begin to be filled up, they become depressed because essentially their life becomes unmanageable and certainly their home unlivable.
Now, what separates them from people who just collect a lot of stuff and have a certain amount of clutter, like my desk?
Well, I think the difference is that when we're dealing with compulsive hoarding, we're talking about bringing in more stuff than your house can actually hold. So the spaces become unlivable. You can't cook because the counter spaces are full. You can't sleep in your bed because it's covered with stuff. People can start to develop what we call goat paths, where there are very narrow pathways in the home where they're trying to get from location to location. So it's really on a continuum, and that's what my book is about, is the idea that all of us can experience having clutter or too much stuff, not so much being a compulsive hoarder, but to where our stuff makes us kind of emotionally unhappy when we get our house.
Is it difficult for hoarders to recognize that they have a problem and need help?
It is. I think for the most part, people who suffer from compulsive hoarding have some level of insight in that, yes, they know that things are getting out of control. But I think what happens is that once it starts getting out of control, they're afraid to ask for help because so many people have judgments. And when their house starts to deteriorate, they're afraid to let people in because, one, they're afraid that people are going to, throw their stuff away without their permission, which happens very, very commonly. And two, they're fearful that, if they have children, child protective services could be called. If they have a dependent elderly there, adult protective services, code enforcement can be called, health department, and so forth. So the more they avoid, clearly things get worse.
And you're a contributing psychologist for the A&E show Hoarders, which viewers often watch with shock and horror. Can you describe some of the homes that you've been in?
Absolutely. Just to be clear, Hoarders is the first of its kind that really uncovered this very, very disabling condition. And, some people say, do you guys stage it? No, this is the real deal. When you see me walk in, I'm walking in for the first time. And, I've had cases of animal hoarding, extreme animal hoarding, where we had a situation where a man had, 3,000 rats that literally took over his home and forced him to move out because they were eating through the walls, and he just could not give up these rats.
Had he brought the rats into the house?
Well, it's an interesting story. What happened was his daughter brought in two rats that came from school, and the cage got knocked over. The rats got loose, and they couldn't find them, fast-forwarding to multiplication, and they just kept going and going and going. And literally, his fear was that if he called someone to come in to get the rats, that they were going to kill him, and he was really quite attached to them. He would sit every morning in the midst of these rats and hand feed them. They would come right up to him, and he was just scared that they would be killed. And so, again, by not doing something, the situation got worse, and lo and behold, he got the rats ate him out of his house.
Too bad the rats didn't learn how to cook. I've seen that film, Ratatouille. They could have made some pretty good meals for him.
The difference is what you see on TV for us is real. Ratatouille is not real, you know. That would have been quite the ideal situation. But, you know, with rats, as you know, even if they cooked for them, you know, you can only have so many cooks in the kitchen, right? And so that's, you know, one extreme case to, you know, people who have these grand plans to recycle, but they never follow through with the plan. So we see people that are, paper hoarders and book hoarders and container hoarders, and it just literally takes over their home.
But you also have people who have garbage and rotting food. That sounds,
yeah.
I mean, that goes beyond saving magazines, because you there's a story in there that you plan to read sometime in the future.
Yeah. I mean, you know, on a daily basis, that person truly believes that they're going to get to it, but they never do. Procrastination is one of the biggest factors that lead to hoarding, no follow through. And in this case, when we're talking about reading, the fear is if I let it go, I'll never get it back and I'll miss that information, when in fact we're in such a life of technology that you can pull up anything nowadays on the internet. We see people who are compulsive hoarders, and expiration dates don't mean a thing. In their mind, the food is still good. And I'm talking people that have food that's up to 30 years old. I worked with a woman whose daughter picked up a jar of containers, glass jars, and we have no idea what it was. It was black. And the daughter was in her 40s and said, I remember when mom prepared these and canned them. And when we tried to get the compulsive hoarder to let go of the jars, she wouldn't do it. And in their mind, it's still good. And there's this, there's what we call cognitive distortions, thinking errors, in which they can't process correctly. And there's this concept of, if I throw this away, it's wasteful. When in fact, the reality is it's more wasteful to keep it, because you're wasting space in your house that you could otherwise use.
Michelle, one of our listeners, has written in asking, isn't hoarding a symptom of feeling the future won't provide?
Yes. I mean, certainly we're in economic times where people are fearful of losing their jobs, and of course many people have lost their jobs. But this is the deal. When we're looking at compulsive hoarding, by and large, most of the people are saving things that they really don't need. And certainly food that's expired, the idea is what if I don't have money for food? But the reality is, even at the end of the day, you're not going to eat food that is that old.
I'm talking with Dr. Robin Zasio, who's a therapist who specializes in treating hoarding and other anxiety-related disorders, and she's a contributor to the A&E show Hoarders and the author of The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. It's published by Rodale. Now, I'm sure many people listening have been cringing to some of these descriptions, but be honest with yourself. You probably have a lot of stuff in your house that you could get rid of. I know every time I go through a box of papers, I wonder, I threw out stuff from this box before. Why did I save this thing? So you got to keep on going through your stuff to throw out things. I have sweaters that have holes in them that I know I'll never wear again, but they're still there. I haven't thrown them out. And I'm sure we all have those kinds of things. We invite your calls. If you have a question or you want to talk about your own problems, We do charge if it goes on for 50 minutes. The number is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. So what are some of the most common things that hoarders do hang on to? Is it newspapers and magazines?
Yeah, I'd say information, whether it be books, magazines, newspapers, articles, past records, that type of thing, because, again, they get into this place where they fear that if they give it up, they will never get it back. And, again, the reality is that we are in a society now where, whether it be, you know, a driver's license or tax documents, you know, we can always access them in some way. I think a lot of people also don't know how long to hold on to things, again, whether it be tax information and other important documents. And so the book really outlines looking at things like expiration dates, how long food is good for, you know, makeup, you know, and then looking at other aspects of the sentimentality of our attachment to stuff. You talk about holy sweaters. You know, what's going on with that sweater? Is it that it has some unique property where if you went camping, it's the warmest sweater you have and a couple holes aren't that big of a deal? Or is it, you know, from college and every time you look at that sweater, you have some really great memories? And you know, the bottom line is you're right. We all hold on to stuff that we don't really need, but we can hold on to them for various reasons. And at the end of the day, really what it comes down to is, are you giving up putting things away that do have value that you use because you're holding on to stuff that you don't really use and it's taking up space? And yeah, so my theory is everything has to have a home, and a home is not in a bag on your floor or on your coffee table. It has a place that it's going to live so that you can access it.
Some of the things that I've saved are just bring back happy memories, like things from trips I've taken. But I guess nostalgia is a major part of this as well. I don't think that I'm at the point of illness, but I may be on the verge. How do you treat someone who does hoard? Are there actually psychological or medical treatments that we can apply?
Well, so far, the research is suggesting that medications aren't really effective when you're looking at compulsive hoarding itself. However, it's very, very important that we look at the factors that are contributing to the hoarding. Are you, you know, avoiding dealing with painful feelings that your stuff helps to cover up? Do you have loss? Do you have trauma? And it's really important that you address those issues so that once those are addressed, then you can look at, you know, how that hoarding has contributed to the avoidance of dealing with the issues. But on top of that, it's also what we call cognitive behavior therapy, which is looking at your cognitions, that's the cognitive aspect, and your thinking, and the distortions that you have about why you're holding on to the stuff, and realizing that oftentimes they're talking in very black and white thought processes, and to kind of help introduce some gray and to see how once your stuff is interfering with your life and it really isn't helping you, then you can begin to break it down and then do what we call the exposure therapy, which is letting go of your stuff and then being able to test out if what you fear is really going to happen. And I got to tell you, 99% of the time when people let go of their stuff, they don't have the regret and the anxiety that they anticipated.
Well, how can you tell someone who hoards that they have a problem without offending or alienating them? Because as we said earlier, there's a certain kind of a clutter blindness that people suffer from.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the key is not to blame and nag and yell and do things behind their back, like go in when they're at work and throw away their stuff, because that ultimately will make it so much worse. You know, the idea is expressing concern and worry about that person, you know, using compassion and understanding And I think even greater than that is recognizing that people don't make a decision to grow up to become a compulsive hoarder. They don't like living that way. They have a mental health issue. And so I think really helping them to understand that, you know, I get that it's not really you. It's the chemicals in your brain. It's fear. And, you know, there is a way out, and what can I do to help you is really the first start. At the end of the day, it's up to them whether or not they acknowledge and recognize it. You know, cliches come up for a reason. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. It's the same exact thing. They've got to identify that this isn't working for them anymore and be willing to accept help.
Let's take a call from Tracy from Middletown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, as I said, my name is Tracy. I'm from Middletown, New Jersey. And my mother-in-law was a hoarder, but they didn't call her that. She was a pack rat at the time. And then my sister-in-law is an extreme hoarder, and we're strange because she does not feel that it's hoarding. She thinks that it's sentimentality, that she's going to doing projects, that it's none of our business. My husband has a tendency to keep things, and, you know, but he's learned to organize them so I don't have to help him deal with it, as we'll say.
But the suggestion here is that there is a genetic component.
That's my concern. And my son is a bit more of a minimalist like myself, but my daughter has a tendency to want to keep things, but I say to her, you have to have a place for everything, everything in its place. You should be able to have a clear surface. So all the surfaces in your room should be cleaned off. You should be able to close your drawers with nothing on. You know, we've kind of set boundaries, but I can see it. And, like, with my sister-in-law, she always had a lot of stuff. But once my mother-in-law passed away, she felt, you could see, like, a switch flipped.
Okay, Robin, you want to address this? The suggestion here is that you said earlier there's a chemical thing going on, which would suggest that there can be a genetic component. Does hoarding tend
Absolutely.
To be in families?
Yes, we definitely see, a history of compulsive hoarding in the family. And the problem is, and Tracy, I think that this is one of the things that it's your sister-in-law, right?
She said her sister-in-law, yeah.
Yeah, is that she's been engaging in this behavior for a very long time. And the longer somebody engages in the behavior, there's like a thickness that begins to happen, and it's harder to dig through it. And I think, you know, as we were talking earlier, you know, the most important thing is that you can try to understand that it's there's a blindness, as we talked about, where somebody can't see through it. It's not that they don't want to. It's just that they can't see through it.
Yes.
And so ultimately, using compassion and understanding and knowing that they have a mental health condition that's preventing them from being able to make good decisions is really where it starts. And,
yeah, but it sounds to me like Tracy kind of has been nagging at them to change their...
No.
Oh, okay.
We had to deal with them because there was an estate issue and a lot of decisions needed to be made about stuff, which was traumatic for everybody involved.
Yeah.
And so it's not that, quite honestly, I have been very sympathetic where my husband was saying, even though he does have these tendencies as well, my husband was saying, let's go in and just clear everything out. And I said, you cannot, because it's like killing one of her children or cutting off a pinky. It's an extension of herself. So I am sympathetic to... You know, how she views it, but I do have, I'm terrified that it's genetic.
Yeah. Well, we have to go to a little break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about those issues. We also have a hoarder on the line. And we'll talk about what you do to clean out a place that is just filled with a lot of awful stuff, whether you have to call in professionals or not. My guest is Dr. Robin Zasio, who's a therapist who specializes in treating hoarding. You probably have seen her on the A&E show Hoarders. She's also written a book called The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. It is published by Rodale. And our number is 212 833-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Robin, a number of people are upset. They feel that we are kind of insulting creative people who save stuff that they will be using in their art or to enhance their lives in other ways. We'll address that as well. First this. We're back with Dr. Robin Zasio. Her book, The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life, published by Rodale. We're talking about hoarding on today's Please Explain segment. And a listener, Michael, said that I'm making too many jokes. This is a serious matter. Robin, is it a bad thing to joke about hoarding?
You know, I don't think that we're joking about hoarding. I think the message that we've been talking about is that it's a very, very serious condition. It's a mental health condition, and it literally destroys lives. And, you know, the book is really outlining, you know, how important it is to address the issue so that you can become, you know, a happy, healthier person. And with any condition, I think that we can use humor to add a little bit of levity in the midst of a really difficult situation.
Well, let's speak to somebody who says she is a hoarder. Suzanne from Dutchess County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Sometimes when I go to the store, I say, oh, well, you know, better not get this because they're going to be after me for the hoarders are coming, the show or something. But I'm really on the borderline, you know, of manageable and not. And I think that's what makes it where the self-deception comes in, because a lot of times you think it's manageable when no one else does. I think a lot of people that are hoarders have maybe always been hoarders in some way, but then something changes in their life. You know, there's less people, the kids move out or whatever. And I know that when the house gets less used, I manage to fill it up. But if it's being used, the spare bedrooms and things are being used, somehow I manage to, I'm either too busy or somehow it's more usable, but the main arteries stay open. But as I'm become less social, I fill up those arteries, and I don't really notice it because I see all the little items as possibilities, as things that, well, I'm going to give that to so-and-so. This reminds me of something I had then. It's all possibilities, and it's very, it may be even self-indulgent or narcissistic in the sense that, that I have this genuine idea that I'm going to catch up with all these things. And that pile of newspapers, well, I'll throw some out, but I really want to fish out the articles that I know would be good to send to you or the one that I really want to read before I see so-and-so. And, you know, I really believe that's going to happen. And the only thing that has taught me, it's more like a cognitive teaching for myself that having to say to myself, well, does that really happen? You know, has that really happened? And I am taking some refuge in the computer, in the sense that, you know, I keep telling myself that these things are replaceable, and I tell myself out loud that, you know, that I don't even remember. Sometimes I unpack boxes, and, you know, really, if I'd never seen some of this stuff again, I would have been fine. But I think a lot of people come from the origins of some of this is a loss in childhood, or not necessarily like the death of a parent, but that can do it, or the change of a divorce or something. But people having to move frequently and having, at a time, losing a dollhouse or losing, you know, their favorite baseball glove or a set of pictures, or losing a grandparent where they had toys stored, that type of thing, coming home from college and having, you know, something, some loss that got to them emotionally that they were not in charge of when it happened.
Suzanne, we let's address some of those issues. Dr. Zasio?
Well, you have a lot to say, and I think it's all very, very insightful. In my book, I outline exactly what you just talked about, in the sense that I think that a lot of people do have histories of hoarding behavior, but I think in some way it kind of it's contained because they do have other people in the house and children, and then the children go away to college, and as people leave their lives, there does become more room for more stuff. And, you know, this talking about sort of these grand plans to give this to so-and-so or to read it, that is one of the biggest contributors that I see that causes people to hold on to their stuff, because there's always a plan. But the problem is the plan never happens, and that's where you've got to really sort of search yourself and say, look, you know, I have these plans to do this, but, you know, if we talk about people that have crafts, you know, I have worked with more people that have a huge amount of crafts, more than one person could really do realistically in one lifetime. And so I think it really is about being honest with yourself about how much stuff you're going to do. And then when you have a plan to get rid of something, or you recognize that you have too much stuff, to follow through. You know, maybe every Wednesday and Saturday you go take something to Goodwill, or you take some crafts to the local school. The key is follow through, because procrastination is a huge contributor to the problem.
Now, a number of listeners have written in with things that are connected to this. A listener in Belmore, Long Island, writes, my problem is that if something is broken, you should try to fix it before you throw it out. I have a lot of broken things in my basement. And then on another, from another angle, an artist left this comment. I'm an artist who makes things from old things, assemblages, and this is a type of art that creates this type of problem. I can find usefulness in nearly everything. How do I discriminate wheat from chaff?
Well, again, we see that a lot, that people are holding on to things because they do see potential. The bottom line is, what you want to do is say, if I fix this, where is it going to live? And having a vision for where that's going to go. And then I think, again, making a plan for, you know, every Saturday for 2 hours, working on fixing those broken items, putting them in the home where they're going to live, and then moving forward. If you decide to fix something and there is no place for it to live in your home, then consider donating it, if it's donatable, or giving it away. But if you have so many things that you plan to fix that year after year you don't get to, the reality is you probably aren't going to get to it, and consider giving them up so that you can have more space in your home for those things that you do actually use.
Let's take another call. This one is Casey from Fresh Meadows. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, my mother has gotten into collecting as well. And whenever I try to intervene and organize and remove the clutter, it becomes a locking of the horns. And therefore, I have to back up, because it becomes a very emotional state.
Now, what does she say is her reason for keeping all these things?
It's her stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's really common.
Not my place.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, somebody, in order for somebody to take action, they first have to recognize that there's a problem. And I think that that's the biggest factor why people don't allow people such as yourself to help, is because they're either fearful of giving up the stuff, they're fearful that someone's going to take their stuff, or they just haven't recognized that there's a problem. In the book, I outline lots of do's and don'ts, how to communicate, you know, what's helpful, what's not helpful. But the reality is that the compulsive hoarder, the person that's suffering, ultimately has to have the choice to decide what to keep, what to throw away, and what to donate. Because if they don't, then they feel like there's a violation happening. You know, I have to say, it's really no different than if I came home from work today and found that I was robbed. Somebody took my stuff without my permission. You know, I may then say they took this, this, and this, and you might say, well, that doesn't seem super valuable. Well, it is to me, you know, and for the person suffering with compulsive hoarding, that stuff, even if it's a newspaper, is important to them, and it's so important to respect that.
Now, there are, we've been talking about people who have their own places and just fill them up, but Kate from Brooklyn asked, what's the best approach to reasoning with a hoarder when you share the living space?
My thought about that is to set boundaries, to sort of talk about the common living areas, and to respect that if there are these common areas, that there are certain places off limits for other people's desk up. The coffee table can have, you know, a reasonable amount of magazines. It can have the remote control, perhaps a Kleenex box, but it's not going to be a dumping zone for somebody's clothing, groceries, office work, and so forth. So, you know, having your room, which you can do what you want with, but keeping the common areas such as the kitchen, dining room table, family room, as areas that are off limits for people to put their stuff.
Matt from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I work with hoarders, helping them get cleaned out, and something I've noticed with several of them is a remarkable memory, almost what I would call a photographic memory, to the extreme of finding a magazine at the bottom of a pile that is from 1980-something, and they'll remember the exact article why they saved that magazine. I'm just wondering if that's something that you see commonly.
Absolutely. And conversely, I see people that hold on to stuff and they go, I have no idea why I'm holding on to this. I just know something happened, you know. In that case, that's when I really encourage them to get rid of them. But, you know, if we're talking about things like articles, Matt, you know, scan them, download them, put them on your computer so that they're accessible. And again, you know, we want to be really clear. We're not talking about, you know, there's nothing wrong with holding on to stuff. It's when it becomes unmanageable. You know, if you're holding on to stuff from high school, every, you know, single report that you wrote, pare them down into, you know, the top 5 months that you're most proud of. Because the reality is when you're holding on to that much stuff, you really don't go through it anyway.
Right. I've also noticed the extreme emotional connections to the most simple things, a scrap of paper from 20 years ago that reminds them of something that is emotional.
Right, right. Well, the reality is, once again, when you have that much stuff, typically you're not accessing it. And so even though people are holding on to them because of memories, it's not until they access it that the memory actually comes up. So again, I think it's holding on to a reasonable amount of stuff and knowing that you're not throwing the memory away when you throw the paper away. Our memories are always there. And so really trusting that process that you can give this up, still be okay, and still remember that event.
Mark in Mount Vernon asks, if a family came in and cleaned out a hoarder's apartment, what's the worst emotional reaction a hoarder would have?
Quite frankly, suicide. I mean, that sounds really extreme, but look, we have to remember and respect that compulsive hoarding is a mental health condition. They're not making a choice to live in their stuff necessarily, in filth, in trash. They have difficulty making good decisions. And again, there's oftentimes trauma or other psychological factors contributing to it. So I know that that word sounds very extreme, but if you go in and you take stuff that is important to people that now they cannot get back, I mean, there can be extremely devastating consequences, depression, you know, acting out, that kind of thing. And then, you know, I think it's important to remember, too, as we talked about earlier, that the person who's suffering from compulsive hoarding needs to have say. They need to develop the skills to start making good decisions. And if you just take all of their stuff without their permission, there's going to be a huge family rift. Again, other psychological factors that can now surface. And the tendency to just re-hoard and fill up the space again is quite likely.
That's what I was going to ask. When their homes get cleared out, do people tend to keep them that way, or do they just go back to the hoarding?
It depends
on whether they've been cooperative or not.
Well, what we're trying to do, we're trying to change the brain chemistry by changing dysfunctional behaviors into functional behaviors. And so if they work the process, they are less likely to go back. You know, I hear so many people say, you know what, yeah, I know I've got a lot of stuff. If I just had a bigger home, then I would have places for it. No, more room means more stuff. So the cognitive behavior therapy and the exposure therapy helps them to learn to start thinking differently and starting to make good decisions.
A listener asked, do hoarders also have a compulsive shopping habit?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely see that. A lot of people who are suffering from hoarding have financial devastation because of the extreme shopping. Where is it a compulsive shopping problem versus a hoarding problem? You know, I don't know that we need to get down to labeling it that specifically, as is you're bringing in too much stuff for your home, and what's going on that, you know, you're engaging in that behavior, and then to break it down and figure out, what's happening when you shop. I mean, most people have a euphoria when they shop. The good deal. I'm famous for buying shoes, going to Macy's, having the coupons, and, you know, buying a pair of shoes that was $150 for $30. It was like, you know, oh, my gosh, I scored. I got this great deal. But if I don't have a place to put it, that's when I have to say, yes, this is a good deal. But ultimately, if I bring it home and I can't access this pair of shoes because it's going to be in the midst of a bunch of other ones, it really is not a good deal. And that's really being able to be more aware of your thinking and making good decisions on the front end.
Now, Robin, we only have about 10 seconds, but I want to ask you, when you call in professionals to clean up, should the hoarder be part of the cleaning up process?
Always, absolutely, because again, they have to be a part of the process so that they can identify the distortions that is causing them to acquire and the difficulty letting go, so that then in the future they can start to make good decisions.
Dr. Robin Zasio, her book, The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life, is published by Rodale. And thank you so much for being our guest on today's Please Explain.